Save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% Lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
After Malone attacks him with some racial slurs, Stone pulls a gun on Malone, which Malone very much appreciates.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
What of mine? What draws my admiration? What is that which gives me joy? Baseball.
Hello, everybody. It is Wreckatopia, episode 140. Who's that to my right over
there? Where the hell am I?
Jeremy Scott, who's making a return. How you doing?
Hey, everybody. I'm well.
All right. And also joining us, Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Nessarinos.
And we'd like to once again welcome chat who have come out here on a Tuesday to watch us talk about movies and things. And I guess I'll start us off with the small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
And it is from 1955. It is a Robert Aldrich movie called Kiss Me Deadly, based on a Mickey Spillane novel. This stars Ralph Meeker as a detective, a private detective named Mike Hammer, who one day while he's driving along notices a woman in peril. That woman in peril is played by Cloris Leachman, who's not going to be around very long in this picture, but it's her film debut, and she tells him a story about how she was being interrogated in a mental institution of some sort, and she had to run away from that, and so in the middle of all this running away and driving her away from that, they run into some bad guys, and the bad guys kill her, and then they try to kill Mike Hammer, but what Mike Hammer has to do after this point is he's intrigued about what she was killed over, and they call it a what's it throughout the movie. This is a what's it that they are looking for, because I'm not sure MacGuffin had been invented yet. But there is a package of some sort that he is looking for throughout this thing, and he has to go through a variety of characters and happenstances and everything to try to solve the case. I love Meeker as Mike Hammer in this. I also love his assistant in this movie. I can't remember her name, but she's obviously like trying to sleep with him the entire movie, and he just keeps on turning her away. He's not interested in sex, he's interested in the job, but she like puts on the full court press as much as you can in 1955 movie to try to get that to happen and everything. But I love it. It's a great movie. It's something that I had not heard of until recently, and highly recommend it.
Yeah, I got to get this one on my list. I haven't seen it yet, so I'll put it on my watch list.
Yeah, check it out.
Polly says, so not the Lita Ford song? Yes, believe me, that song was going through my head all the time while I would pop in this movie in. So. who wants to be next?
I'll go.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, one of the hardest things to do was to pick a small recommend for this show, because I have like 55 things I want to recommend that have all accrued over the last 6 months.
But let's do it. Let's go. Start one and we'll go through all 55.
No, I got to save them.
All right. Fair enough.
I'm going to try and be timely with this one. There is a movie, I believe, is in theaters or has maybe already come and gone with Tom Hanks called Here, directed by one Robert Zemeckis. And it sounds, doesn't have great reviews, and it sounds like bland and boring crap to me because it takes place over many decades in the same house and the camera never moves. It's in the same static position the entire movie. Zemeckis has become too gimmicky for me in the last 10, 15 years. But as I'm reading about this movie, I learned, and I see a lot of comments on Reddit and the YouTube comments saying, oh, the graphic novel this is based on is amazing. And I'm like, oh, graphic novel. I could see it working in a graphic novel context better than it does in a movie. So I bought it. And it's called Here, and it's by Richard McGuire. I read it about 40 minutes, and it's thick, but there's just not a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of, I mean, it goes back 400 years at times. It goes back, it goes into the future, thousands of years. It's just fantastic. I gave it to my wife. She gave it to her friend. Everyone I've given it to has loved it. My brother's coming here for Thanksgiving, and I'm going to make him sit and read it for 40 minutes. You can find it online, several retailers. I highly, highly recommend it. And it's called Here by Richard McGuire.
Yeah. I was surprised. I was actually surprised that the movie, the trailer look for the movie seemed like, oh, this might be interesting, but apparently I guess it sounds like the gimmick is the main thing about that movie or whatever. And they did, I don't know. Did, when you read this, did it look like something that could be turned into a good movie, or is this really a graphic novel only type of thing?
No, I don't see how it could work as a movie at all. And I'm sure, again, I haven't seen the film. I'm sure he cast Hanks and Robin Wright. So I'm sure they're in it most of the time. So the movie is only going to span, you know, a much shorter time period, where again, the book goes back to like BC, goes into the fucking future with aliens. but it's really humanizing. It's really, it made me think a ton about the spaces I've inhabited and who has inhabited them before me and who will inhabit them after me. And I thought it was really powerful. So anyway, there you go. If you can find it, check it out. Chris, if you want to borrow mine, we can do it.
Awesome.
Future Conan?
I thought of that too. I've thought of these type of things too. You ever like think about like what something looked like before the interstate went through it? You know, you have like the rocks, the sides of the rocks there, and like it used to be a big, huge hill that they blasted through and whatever, stuff like that. You know, it'd be really cool.
It's one of my favorite parts of like time travel movies is when they'll do the montage of traveling through time, and they'll just stay, they'll lock in on like a piece of land or something, and then all the houses will go up, and then a war will tear them down, and then they'll go up again, and like, yeah, just that idea that how things change over time, and we're small. That
Freedom Tower you went up, Chris, in New York City, don't they do like a presentation of that where they like do. They show you New York rising?
Yeah. It shows you the like building of New York, and then it shows you the old Twin Towers, and then there's a very delicate disappearance of those as you get past 2001 and everything. But it's a really cool presentation.
I'll have to give a hand on this graphic novel. I'm interested in the movie. I tend to I don't know. I like Robert Gimmickus better than you guys do, but I think it could be interesting. Of course, it's Tom Hanks too. I don't know how Tom Hanks misses. I just, you know, he always seems to be good and stuff, so I'm interested to check it out at least.
Yeah, he's good in Terminal, but Terminal isn't good.
Fair. That's a fair it's a fair thing. It's a fair thing you just said, Jeremy.
All right.
My small recommend it's been out for a little bit now, but I'm just getting around to it. It is Saturday Night, which is the Reitman film about the day, or actually the hour and a half leading up to the very first episode of Saturday Night Live. This is not meant to be historical fact. This is meant to be a dramatization based on kind of the realities of these people and the reality of that episode. So there are plenty of Easter eggs. Like, if you've seen the first episode, you'll recognize like the skits they're, the sketches they're preparing for, all the different things. You'll certainly recognize the people. And it'll feel true. Like, there's stuff about Chevy Chase that feels true to how we understand that human being. There's stuff about, you know, Lorne Michaels that feels true to what we understand about that human being. There's stuff about Milton Berle that feels true to what we understand about that human being. But it is one of those movies that I'm a sucker for, which is like, oh, I know these real life people. I've seen a ton of their work. It's fun watching somebody else try to kind of capture their essence in a dramatic situation like this. And for the most part, I think it really succeeds. Nobody is doing like a straight imitation. Everybody is just kind of being the essence of these people. Standouts for me were the Garrett Morris, Lamorne Morris, no relation technically, playing Garrett Morris was really good. I like what they did with that character. I loved Dylan O'Brien as Dan Aykroyd. His Aykroyd is perfect in this movie. And I don't mean perfect imitation. I just mean it feels like Dan Aykroyd, even though it doesn't really look like him in that way. The Chevy Chase is really good. And then Gabriel LaBelle, who I think was Fablemans, was probably where he broke out, is doing really good work as Lorne Michaels. I will say he looks a little too young, but maybe that's the point. Maybe the point is to, you know, realize how young Lorne Michaels was in that moment trying to do this. Mm-hmm. And he's not doing the typical, you know, Dr. Evil impersonation of Lorne Michaels, but you still get a sense of that person in the performance that he's doing. More than anything, it's just a really fun, quick watch. It feels very Sorkin-esque, which no surprise means it feels very Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, kind of with a lot of the ways and, that they're doing things here. So I just had a really good time and enjoyed the movie. So I would recommend it to others as well.
Yeah, this was one I wanted to watch last week, and there was one theater that still had like two shows in a day. And I was like, I better watch it while it's, and I never had. Could never make it work. So now I'm looking for it to be on streaming soon so I can watch it, because I've wanted to see this ever since it was announced, even, but I just never could make it work to watch it. So yeah.
Well, and a lot of your enjoyment could be, or a lot of my enjoyment probably was, how much of a Saturday Night Live fan I am. I mean, this show is, you know, going on 50 years, right? Like,
yeah, it'll be have its 50th anniversary, I think.
Yeah, so I think it was 75, right around there. And I think I've watched all the episodes. Like, I've gone back and watched all the old seasons, and I know a lot of these stories and these characters. So stuff like, for instance, you know, Jim Henson was on that first season of Saturday Night Live with the Muppets, but everybody there hated him, like hated the Muppets being on Saturday Night Live, the like writers and producers and stuff. And some of that stuff is in the Jim Henson documentary, which is on Disney Plus and also good. So to watch kind of Nicholas Braun play Jim Henson is a really interesting thing.
Of course, he's playing the character nobody liked.
Well, get this. He has a dual role. He also plays... Why can't I think of the comedian that was way out there, Andy
Kaufman?
Kaufman. He also plays Kaufman.
I was sitting there going Kaufman, and it came out Warhol anyway.
So he also plays Andy Kaufman. So he has kind of a dual role, but it works both ways. I just had a blast. That's all. It's just a really fun watch. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoy it.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to it when I get a chance. I hope it's streaming very soon.
Yeah, you're in luck, Chris. I just checked Amazon, and you can rent it or buy it today on Amazon. Oh, okay. Prime.
Yeah, I knew it was had to be soon because it was in that particular stage of its theater
life. You can also get the Joker 2 if you want. Ooh.
Is it my birthday?
Not to watch that film.
Wasn't that available like 2 weeks after it came out? Like, it was crazy how quick that was on VOD.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to go on to our big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
And that is The Untouchables from 1987. I picked this specifically because Jeremy was coming back, and I know that this is one of his favorites. And Aaron, I'm assuming this is one of your favorites too. I'm not sure. Oh, he's not going to say.
That means no.
And so I will get on into it then. Untouchables is a 1987 Brian De Palma film suggested by a 1957 book written by Oscar Fraley and Elliot Ness, which was turned into a TV series in 1959. The screenplay was written by David Mamet, nominated for only 4 Oscars, which makes no sense to me. Sean Connery won for Best Supporting, while the costumes, art direction, and the fucking awesome Ennio Morricone score just had the honor of being nominated. In the Best Picture race, The Last Emperor won over Broadcast News, Moonstruck, Hope and Glory, and Fatal Attraction. The Untouchables couldn't get into that. Couldn't bust those 5 like robust moves. Look, I love Broadcast News. I think that needs to be there. Moonstruck
is okay.
Okay. Fatal Attraction. I didn't even see Hope and Glory. I can't speak to Hope and Glory, but The Last Emperor, that's a slog, man. That's a slog. Now that I'm older, I'll love that movie. But
no, you won't. I watched it 2 years ago, and it was the first time I'd ever seen it. And I was like, what the fuck? This is a snooze.
Yeah, The Untouchables blows away all these movies. And I'm saying this from someone who has Broadcast News in their heart. And I know Jeremy does, too. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, was there something against De Palma and David Mamet and all these people? None of those guys got nominated either. Anyway, it's 1930 during the era of Prohibition in Chicago, where gangs have been battling over who controls the billion-dollar illegal alcohol racket. The top guy in this business is Al Capone, played by Robert De Niro, and probably friend of the show by this point. We've done a lot of Robert De Niro movies in this podcast. Being shown here getting a shave while sycophantic press stands by. Capone tells them he's a man of the people, just giving them what they want. When asked about his violent methods, he brushes it off as some effect of living in a bad neighborhood. When the barber accidentally cuts him, Capone looks ready to strike, but knowing the press is there gives the guy a break. But then is quick to add that neither he or his people actually participate in the violence that is well known throughout the city. We are taken to a small bar where a bartender is telling a gangster that he won't buy the shitty beer they've been selling to him. Once the gangster leaves, another shady character in an all-white suit that we later find out is Frank Nitti, played by Billy Drago, or Drago if you're a Rocky fan, leaves the bar without his briefcase, which then explodes in a little girl's hands when she tries to flag the guy down. Mm. We are now taken to the home of Elliot Ness, played by Kevin Costner, and his wife, played by Patricia Clarkson. Ness is reading about the bar bomb in the newspaper. His wife tells him that it's time to go to work. He works as a special agent of the Department of the Treasury, as the city of Chicago has invited federal agents to crack down on illegal liquor. The press once again shows how little they take this seriously and even asks Ness if all of this is just for show. Ness then tells him it's not a showpiece and that prohibition is the law of the land, and that's how he feels about it. Ness's first mission is brought to him by an undercover agent who tells them that a very large shipment of Canadian whiskey has arrived and they're going to crack down on the warehouse where it's stored. Later that night, Ness leads the charge only to find out the crates are filled with umbrellas and an eager press photographer is there to catch Ness's embarrassment. He becomes kind of a joke before he's even started. While he wallows in pity on a bridge, he is scolded by Chicago beat cop Jim Malone, played by Sean Connery, for throwing a note from his wife that says she's proud of him into the river. When Malone asks why Ness is carrying a gun, he says he's a treasury officer, which is apparently good enough for him. When Ness asks him why he took his word, Malone says, "Who would claim to be that who was not?" It becomes pretty clear that Malone knows his shit. And when Ness says he's going to go home, he tells him that's the number one thing for you to do as a cop. When your shift is over, you go home alive. kind of interesting considering what happens to Malone later in the movie. Not long after, Ness is knocking on Malone's door. He believes that Malone and a few handpicked cops can do this job, but Malone resists, believing himself to be just a beat cop and that he's probably too old to be getting into dangerous business such as this. Ness then meets accountant Oscar Wallace, played by Charles Martin Smith, who has been sent from Washington to help out. His idea for getting Capone is very quaint. He wants to get him on income tax evasion. After that, Malone and Ness are at a church, with Malone willing to join on the crusade, as long as maybe the last crusade, as long as Ness is willing to get his hands dirty. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one to the, one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way. How did Mamet not get nominated for this? Malone is like the devil offering a deal inside the church. They shake on it, with Malone considering this a blood oath. Malone then takes Ness through the basics, asking why Capone knew about the raid that went bad, and he rightly answers that there are bad cops on the force who informed Capone. Now what? Who can you trust? Malone suggests you have to find a star cadet, someone who isn't entrenched in the dirty Chicago PD. It's here that they meet a so-called George Stone, played by Andy Garcia, who Malone gets to admit is changed from his original Italian name. After Malone attacks him with some racial slurs, Stone pulls a gun on Malone, which Malone very much appreciates. The three of them, along with the accountant Oscar, now go on a legal liquor raid at the U.S. Post Office, no less. Malone tells Ness everyone knows where the booze is. The problem isn't finding it. The problem is who wants to cross Capone. They then crack into a room marked with a stairway closed sign on it and find a ton of liquor crates and people to arrest. We now go back to Capone, who's speechifying in front of his men in a famous speech involving a baseball bat. Capone emphasizes the importance of being on a team. When one guy seems to be agreeing with him in a way that seems a little over the top and maybe not all that serious, Capone beats him to death with the baseball bat. Not long after that, we see Nitty in a car outside of Ness's residence, making veiled threats to Ness about his house and his family. Ness smartly sends his family away from the known residence. He wants to hurt Capone now, which is good, because Malone soon arrives at the scene to tell Ness about another shipment they can raid. This will require a flight to the Canadian border. The Untouchables team, with the Canadian Mounties, for what will be a shipment from Canada being sold across the border in the United States, with a bridge stretching from one country to the other. There's a lot of waiting in a house located near the bridge, but eventually the meet takes place, with the American gangsters armed to the teeth. The crew jumps on horseback to intercept, only to see the Mounties jumping the gun on the Canadian side and immediately forcing all the parties on the bridge to flee. With the Mounties chasing on one side and the Untouchables heading the gangsters off on the American side, a gunfight ensues. Stone gets shot, but is okay, but this spurs the accountant Oscar into action mode, and he kills a few guys, even charging one of them down when he runs out of bullets and beats him with his shotgun. Oh yeah, and he doesn't forget to drink some of the alcohol that's spewing out of one of the shot up barrels. Ness and Malone shoot up a car, and Malone runs down a guy named George, played by Brad Sullivan, who runs away from it. Another gangster in all white, not to be confused with the scary murdery guy, Frank Nitti, runs to the stakeout house. Ness ends up reluctantly shooting that guy when he doesn't put his gun down. Luckily, though, Malone has his guy, George, who's got a satchel full of evidence, including a ledger that shows where all the money is going. However, it does seem to need some decoding to be real evidence, so they ask George to do it for them. But he is very tight-lipped. That's when Malone goes outside and picks up the guy Ness killed and does a very violent Weekend at Bernie's on him, doing a whole show just outside the window, pretending that the other gangster is still alive, and then blowing him away when he doesn't give him what he wants. That, of course, makes George talk. Capone finds out about this and gives the famous line about wanting Ness dead, his family dead, his house burned to the ground, and he wants to piss on his ashes. After a scene where Ness and his wife welcome a baby boy at the hospital, so begins a classic De Palma over 2-minute unbroken shot, starting with the DA announcing that Capone is being served a subpoena for income tax evasion. Oscar is tasked in bringing George to a safe house. I don't know why they task Oscar to do this, by the way. That's some movie shit. They get into an elevator at the police station where we notice the operator's Frank Nitti. The inevitable happens. We are given some insight that the Irish cop Mike, played by Richard Bradford, assisted the killings, but he gets terrible news when he looks down from a ledge and sees that another cop got killed when the gangster runs out of the elevator. When Ness opens the elevator, he sees George and Oscar dead, and there's a message written in blood inside that says "touchable." This spurs him on to pay Capone a visit at the Lexington Hotel where he's staying, and he threatens to fight him. Ness calls him a racial slur. Capone tells him, "Fuck you and your family." Ness draws a gun, but then Capone's men all pull guns to show how useless this challenge was. Capone rubs it into Ness that he has nothing now. And this is confirmed when the DA tells you got nothing. And this is confirmed when the DA tells Ness without a witness, the case is over. Malone asks Ness to stall the DA's announcement as he has one more trick up his sleeve. A brief scene shows that Capone's bookkeeper, Walter Payne, played by Jack Kehoe, is being moved out of town by Capone until the subpoena blows over. Malone finds Mike at a pool hall, and they take a conversation to an alley where we discover that Mike has been Malone's informant the whole time. Malone now wants Mike to give him the whereabouts of Capone's bookkeeper. Malone threatens Mike with knowledge he has about him. Mike threatens Malone's life. Then they fight, ending with Malone pulling a gun on Mike and threatening his life. Malone ends up calling Stone and telling him he knows where Walter Payne is. After Capone plays around with the sycophantic press one more time, downplaying income tax evasion, we are now taken to a true De Palma trademark. It's another long unbroken shot, but it's one that recalls his earlier work, especially the silly movie within a movie being made in Blowout. Only this is played straighter and with more tension than almost anything De Palma has ever done. It is set up by showing Nitti outside of Malone's residence holding a matchbook with Malone's address on it. He then passes the baton to another gangster who spies on Malone from the outside. He finds an open window, goes through the house, doesn't find Malone, but when he turns around, he sees him at the other end of the hallway. When he pursues, Malone turns around with a gun and sees the gangster with a knife in his hand. After chiding the guy for bringing a knife to a gunfight, Malone chases him down to the outside where Nitti is waiting to gun him down. Nitti tells Capone about it at the opera. Ness finds Malone at his house, still alive, miraculously. And before he died, he got shot like 15 times, 20 times.
I got like 3 notes about that, man. There's no fucking way.
There's like a coat of blood on the floor that he's been dragging himself down. Like, it's insane. Before he dies, he's able to eke out that the bookkeeper is going to be on a 1205 train going to Miami. This leads to the movie's ultimate action set piece at a train station, particularly a set of stairs that serves as the center of the action. A woman pulls a baby carriage up the stairs. Other innocents start filing into the station. Ness starts helping with the baby, knowing that they could be in harm's way. But on the way up, he notices some men who could be Capone's, and nearly at the top, notices Walter Payne being escorted down the stairs. Soon, Ness and one of Capone's men recognize each other, and the guns come out. In a slow motion sequence that destroys everything Zack Snyder has ever done, Ness blows away the one guy and turns to face another, causing the baby carriage to fall down the stairs. Walter runs, but eventually is frozen, not wanting to run into some bullets. Another gangster tries to get into the action, but Stone gets that guy. Now we've got a full-on gun battle on the stairs with a baby carriage falling down the middle of it. There's one gangster at the bottom of the stairs and another injured one on the stairs. Ness makes a run after the carriage while the injured gangster takes aim and fires wildly at innocent people, including the baby. Ness fires at the guy at the bottom of the stairs, who's now hiding behind a column, but runs out of bullets. Now Stone comes around another column and throws Ness a new gun while sliding to stop the carriage from crashing. Ness kills the guy at the bottom of the stairs. Now the injured gangster takes Walter as a human shield, and after a tense standoff where Stone tells Ness he's got him, still holding the carriage, by the way, Ness eventually gives the order for Stone to shoot, and he does, killing the guy and keeping Walter alive. The next scene is Walter testifying against Capone with the ledger evidence, which implicates law enforcement and the judiciary. However, Capone doesn't seem worried, and when Nitti gives a note to Capone, Ness requests the bailiff, and tells him that Nitti is carrying a gun and the bailiff escorts him out with Ness. During a low angle shakedown, they find that Nitty has a gun, a get out of jail free card from the mayor, and a matchbook, the one that Ness used to find Malone's address, and Ness uses it to light a cigarette. The matchbook has Malone's address on it, so when Ness brings it up, Nitty pulls a gun on the bailiff. Despite Ness telling him to let him go, the bailiff pulls his own gun and is shot. Ness chases Nitty up to the roof of the courthouse. During a shootout, Ness appears to fall off the roof, but when Nitty checks up on him, he finds he's fallen to a lower ledge, and Ness takes a shot that goes through Nitty's hat. Some more chasing and shooting leads to Nitty finding a rope to climb down. He tries to smash through a window while Ness struggles whether to kill the man in cold blood. Nitty eventually starts climbing back up, realizing that Ness can't do it. Nitty taunts Ness, telling him that Malone died screaming like a stuck Irish pig. To think about that when he beats the rap. Ness then throws Nitty off the courthouse roof. And probably one of the worst falling off of a building scenes I've ever seen. It was not very well done. Green screen, blue screen type stuff. Not very well done. After that, Stone shows Ness the note that Nitty gave Capone. It shows that they've bribed the jury. The judge gives it no credence, though, and Ness, fed up, tells everyone to leave the room so he can talk to the judge alone. I don't think any of this shit, by the way, is something that anybody can do or facilitate. But
oh, you mean the old jury swap?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. But even the clear the room, I'm a treasury guy. I'm going to talk to the judge. Not going to happen either. But next scene, the judge looks shook. He tells the bailiff to go into another court and bring the jury from there and switch it out with the one in his court, which is total bullshit, but this is a movie. It is absolute nonsense, but we forgive it. It's The Untouchables. It's a great movie. The DA.
I guess I'll just interrupt now. Say that's actually one of the true parts of the movie that the judge actually did switch the juries. I guess it's legal.
How is that legal?
It actually happened, according to the internets, at least.
That isn't legal, and so therefore, maybe there was maybe there were different laws, and it was Chicago.
It was before voir dire, it was before they'd been sworn in and everything.
Before they did select the jury.
Yeah, he did switch them. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well. Yeah. All right. Well, maybe not total bullshit, but man, it reads like total bullshit today.
It sure does.
The DA asked Ness what he told the judge, and Ness says that he told the judge his name was in the Capone ledger. And even though it wasn't, the judge couldn't call the bluff. Capone's defense attorney now wants to change Capone's not guilty plea to guilty without his client's consent. Maybe this is something that you could do, too. He just up and changes the plea in the middle of the courtroom. Ness walks over to tell Capone that you're never going to never stop fighting until the fight is done. After some reflection and a goodbye with Stone, Ness is approached by someone from the press who asks if they ever repeal prohibition, what will you do next? And he says, I think I'll have a drink. And the awesome Ennio Morricone score takes us to the credits. Guys, what did you think of The Untouchables?
I want to hear Mr. Naysayer's opinion over here.
Really? You want me to bring the podcast down first? Don't you just want to like celebrate it for a bit before I say my thing?
No, I'm going to celebrate it no matter what you say.
Okay, cool. So I'm going to say something that is going to make you very angry, and then I'm going to explain it, and you'll still be very angry.
Sounds fun.
This is The Greatest Showman of gangster movies. This is a movie that is technically incredible. Like, it's made really well. The performances are awesome. The action is astounding. There are like three or four all-timer scenes in this movie, just like all-timer tension. That baby on the stairs is one of the greatest scenes in cinema history. It's
you're not making me angry. I don't know what you're talking about.
Incredible. But it's all on a bed of lies that makes it hard for me to enjoy the movie. Like there are several things about this movie that make it difficult for me to not be distracted by the stuff that's going on. One is that we answered a question recently about what, you know, true to life movie plays loose and fast with reality in a way, but you still love the movie. This is probably a great answer for that question because
almost none of this happened.
Like this turns one of the beautiful things about Elliot Ness, which is that he didn't use violence, that he didn't use, you know, fight fire with fire, that he used math and science and investigation and targeted raids to put a dent in Capone's empire, and just turns it into a cowboys and, you know, and bad guys shoot him up, you know, kind of thing. Turns him into a cold-blooded murderer at the end, by the way. And in real life, he was a guy that didn't even like carrying a gun. He usually had his holster empty. Like, he just, you know, he didn't like the violence part of what was going on. So in many ways, it's that part's hard for me. Plus, Capone even didn't, like, he specifically through that time is said to have said, do not touch these people. Like, it is not worth the trouble to go after these people. So the whole movie just feels like complete fiction in the way that it would have been better if it wasn't, they weren't named Elliot Ness and Al Capone. Like, if this was a movie about, you know, Frank Rogers and, you know, Justin Mayflower, I have no idea why, then maybe I have a different opinion. But it's just a movie that revels in the revenge aspect of the violence, like that whole, if he's got a knife, you get a gun. If he puts, you know, one of yours in the hospital, put one of his in the morgue. Great line, but I don't subscribe to that philosophy. Like, you know, like that's a terrible, in my opinion, way to see the world. So the movie for me has this really backwards idea of justice and how to get things done. So all of that makes it difficult for me to get on board with what's going on in this movie.
So, well, that sounds to me a little bit like the opposite of The Greatest Showman's problem, because they made a terrible person great.
Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. It is the mirror image of that.
And I guess here's one thing I want to talk to you about that I think I agree with. This movie does not reconcile with what it does to Elliot Ness as a man. Like, this time through, I was really focused on, basically, it's almost a fall from grace. By the end of this movie, instead of the hokey, wide-eyed optimist at the beginning, he's a stone-cold killer who throws a felon off the roof instead of letting him face justice. So he has completely changed as a man, and the movie kind of loves him for it.
Mm-hmm.
It gives him that, I think I'll have a drink. Like, he's the absolute hero at the end of this movie, and it does not reconcile with what Malone turned him into with his style. And I think that's an interesting thing to pick apart. The movie's not interested in that at all.
No.
So I guess I understand where you're coming from, even if I don't feel the same way.
Let me clarify. I don't hate this movie. What I'm talking about is a cognitive dissonance, right? Like, what I'm talking about is this idea of, I'm watching great filmmaking. And this is what I mean when I say Greatest Showman. Like, I'm listening to the soundtrack of Greatest Showman and going, these are some of the greatest songs ever written. But I have this cognitive dissonance of, you know, what I, not only what the truth is in the situation, but also what I believe, right? Like, how it impacts the worldview and thematic ideas of this movie are opposite of how I see the world. And so that cognitive dissonance gets a little loud and makes it hard to just like fully enjoy the amazing movie making. So, yeah.
I respect your opinion here, Dicer, even though I'm going to shit on it here.
No, go for it. No,
I'm not going to shit on it. I am going to say this, though. Once you say that if this movie just changes the names of the characters and it's not based on a reality, does all the stuff that you feel about the violence in the movie change?
No. That's specifically in regards to the untruth to Elliot Ness. No, okay, it doesn't change the other stuff.
So you think that they change the names, then you're with us how great this movie is, though.
No. If they change the names, I still have the cognitive dissonance of the worldview. To deal with. It was just the 1-2 punch of the worldview and the fact that in reality, Elliot Ness was a little bit more, kind of saw the world the way I did. And so that makes it extra dissonancy so to speak, as I'm watching it.
I want to make it clear before we go any further. I do hate The Greatest Showman. Just so nobody.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
I wanted to talk about the three scenes that I think you're talking about. And I wrote there are three scenes in this movie that all pulse with tension and make this movie sing: the Canadian border scene, Nitty killing Connery in his apartment, and the train station shootout. Each one of those scenes would be the best scene in any other movie, and they're all three in this one movie. Like, De Palma shot the shit out of this movie, and it's evident. He's got the split diopters, he's got the POV shots, he's got the going into the hotel elevator, riding it all the way up, and going into Capone's suite in a one shot. I love specifically the opening shot of Capone getting a shave and being nice with the media as we pan down slowly. And then a little bit later in the dinner scene where he kills that dude with the baseball bat, get the overhead shot again that pans up away slowly now that it's clear he's a monster. And I just feel like De Palma is so intentional, which flies in the face of how he actually is, because he said the train station scene he made up as he went. He crafted the shots as they shot the sequence. I don't even know how that's possible. That's one of the greatest scenes of all time. And one of the reasons that scene is so great and so tense is that he lets it build. Like, it's a 9-minute, 33-second scene, and he lets it build for 6 full minutes before any guns come out. So you're feeling every bit of this. Like, every time the door opens, every time you hear a muffled voice, you're like, it amps up the tension a little bit further. It's probably one of my favorite scenes of all time. And this is in the top five of my favorite movies of all time. And it's weird that two of my five favorite movies of all time both have Sean Connery speaking a Scottish accent completely out of place. One as a Russian and one as an Irish person. Apparently that was a big deal when the movie came out, that like the UK and Ireland, they were all up in arms that Connery was playing an Irish guy, and they got even madder when he won the Oscar, which is hilarious to me. Take that, you know, sugar drinking, paper straw using British.
Listen to the outtakes.
Whoa, Jeremy.
Settle down.
I guess those don't make sense when you hear the outtakes.
Yes.
Let's see. Do I have anything else here? I do love this movie because it is to me everything. Do you like crime movies? It's got it. Do you like action? It's got it. Do you like shootouts? It's got it. Do you like courtroom dramas? It's got it. Do you like chase movies? Yep. Do you like naive moralistic heroes who will somehow succeed? On and on and on. It is every kind of movie. Somebody in the comments said earlier when you were talking about the Canadian border scene that because we had Costner and Morricone, and of course the movie had to turn into a Western for a little bit. And it kind of does. I love every choice that De Palma made in this film. I just love it. If I could make a movie, my stuffed animal or security blanket, this movie would be in the running.
I'm the same way. I know how it feels though when you find out that nothing in the real world happened, and you know nothing in the movie happened in the real world, and everything. Back when I was a big, huge JFK guy, and I still think that movie's great, but finding so many different things that were just, you know, made up or just came off of scant evidence, and he turned it into a huge thing in that, whatever, it does taint that movie quite a bit. Even though when you first watch JFK, you're like, well, how much of this is true? I don't know. Something was wrong, damn it. Something was wrong. And you just don't care how many, like, bad faith or how many, you know, things that they came up with in that movie had very little evidence to work off of or whatever. Oliver Stone today, though, still is like, we've presented evidence to the American people that no one has ever seen before. Well, it's because it's not evidence. So I understand that, I guess, but I'm also in this mode now where I'm just like, the movie doesn't do the real world thing. Okay. It was suggested by a book. Yes. You kind of need name recognition, Elliot Ness and Al Capone to kind of sell your movie. I don't know if Kevin Costner was even a big star by the time The Untouchables rolls around. So they fill it up with Connery and De Niro and all that to sort of surround him. They went
to Don Johnson first.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And Kevin Costner, then it's not long after this, becomes a huge star after this. Became the number one star in the United States, I'm pretty sure. Maybe the world after this movie came out. But I've gotten to the point now where, like, if it's not the real thing, I expect that. Watch that Woman of the Hour and how many things didn't happen in that, you know? You've brought up Saturday Night as a movie that's very light on the historical aspects of it. I think we just had kind of grown to accept this as these are not documentaries and everything. However, we would, if we send this movie, take it to task for not being a documentary.
I also read even Capone. He opened and funded a soup kitchen that ran during the Depression and fed hot meals three times a day to more than 2,000 people. I don't know. It's just
the movie
can't show you that Capone. I get it, but
this movie can't. Right. I think that's right. And I think there's a game we play, and I played it with this movie watching it. And by the way, I came to this movie recently. I think I watched it for the first time within the last 4 years. So it's not something I cut my teeth on, so to speak. But I think we play this game sometimes with movies where it's like, wouldn't it have been a better movie if they did this? You know, wouldn't this make it a better movie if they did this? And it is worth remembering that the movie makers get to decide what they want their movie. Like, they are trying to make their version of the movie in their mind. And yes, we can come up with things, and sometimes they're valid, and sometimes they're worth exploring, even in just an intellectual way. But at the end of the day, we really should look at a movie as succeeding or failing on its own merits. And in many ways, I do think this movie succeeds wonderfully on its own merits, on what it's trying to do and the kind of movie it's trying to be. Would I have enjoyed the more nuanced movie where Capone does good things and we actually know that Ness is on his third wife and is terrible with women and, you know what I mean? Like, the more nuanced version of this story? Yeah, I would have. That would have been more interesting to me. More interesting to me would have been the story of how Prohibition was a terrible law, and yet they're still having to defend it this way. This movie hints at that movie that's interested in, like, how do you defend something that you know is going to, like, that whole speech with the guys, like, if you, you know, I know some of you drink or whatever.
Yeah,
but don't now or whatever. And ending on the, you know, I think I'll go get a drink. Like, it hints at that movie, but actually focusing on that theme might have been more interesting to me. But that's not really the playground this movie was aiming to play on. And
I mean, I would love a deep dive documentary about this.
Sure, yeah.
Like, because Ness died and they'd forgotten him. Like, not a single Chicago paper even carried the news of his death. Like, the city forgot him. Capone, he's like in his late 20s when all this is supposed to be going down. Like, you don't stop to think about that, but he's like 30 years old, basically, when he goes away to jail. So, yeah, I think there's a fascinating way to tell the true events, but this movie is not interested in any of that.
Right. Yeah. And at the end of the day, this spectacular movie, again, that I think is technically an achievement, what it is interested in, the themes and messages it is interested in about how the good guys take down the bad guys, it just doesn't vibe with how I see the world. So, like, that's the major cognitive dissonance for me. And that's just the me thing. But yeah, it's all spectacular. Right.
Well, enough of wrong opinions. Let's go on to our big. Let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Jeremy, do the honors.
Oh, shit. I don't want to steal Aaron's. I doubt I'm going to steal Aaron's.
You're not.
I sat for a very, very long time on The Godfather because of the similar good guy, wants to be good, ends up being corrupted in the pursuit of justice, falls from grace, essentially. I really wanted to make that work, but I just don't think there's enough outside of Ness and Pacino's character to connect those two films together. So I'm going to go with a movie that is not the same in tone at all, but you'll see the connection immediately. And I'm going to pair it with Road to Perdition because this takes place in Capone's Northern Illinois. Capone looms large over Road to Perdition, and I don't think his name is ever mentioned. And this is, you get another Frank Nitti in this movie that is much more like the real Frank Nitti in that he was not an assassin. He sat behind a desk. He made big decisions for Capone, just like he's doing in Road to Perdition. And so because I feel like those two movies are in the same world, inhabiting the same universe or time, I think that would be a really interesting double feature, in part because of the contrast of how the two films approach that era. So there you go.
Yeah. I love that choice. I did consider that choice. That was on my short list. I think that's a good one. I eventually went with Copland for my
on my list. That's on my list
for my double feature. I think tonally and structurally they're very similar movies, and I think the one difference for Copland is the reluctance of the Sylvester Stallone character, which adds, I think, an interesting nuance to what he's doing to eventually take down the mob and the things that are going on here, whereas Ness, you know, was very ardent in his what he was doing. So, but yeah, I think they go well together and would be a good, 1-2 punch.
That's a future big recommend. I've said it a few times. Copland will eventually be there. I gave you a chance to be a cop and you blew it.
You blew it.
I want to give a shout out to R1MA78 who had a super secret double feature of Battleship Potemkin. And I think that's mainly because of the baby carriage scene that's in that one. It's an old silent movie. If you've ever never seen Battleship Potemkin, it's really well done. It also has a stairway scene. A lot of this movie is people running down a stairway. But yeah, there's a baby carriage that comes down. Of course, The Untouchables is clearly paying homage to that in this as well. But that's a good a double feature for this movie. And we had a lot of good ones in the chat as well. A lot of good ones that came up there. Catch Me If You Can and American Gangster and stuff like that. But all right, next week is going to be Jeremy's turn to give us a big recommend. So Jeremy, what is it?
I also have a bunch of these stacked up now too, but as usual, it's going to be dependent on what's available in streaming and what's not. I didn't want to come with my first recommend back being something you had to pay for unless you don't have Netflix. So we're going to go with 2018's Upgrade from Lee Whannell, starring Logan Marshall Green. And the Wikipedia summary says this. A brutal mugging leaves Gray Trace paralyzed in the hospital. A billionaire inventor soon offers him a cure, an artificial intelligence implant called STEM that will enhance his body. Now able to walk, Gray finds that he also has superhuman strength and agility, skills he uses to seek revenge on the thugs who destroyed his life. I love this movie. I've seen it at least 3 times. It's got some really inventive ideas and action, and it's all on a very low budget. And I'm very excited to look at it through the Recotopia lens. And again, that is on Netflix. Upgrade will be next week's homework.
And I promise not to spend my review lamenting how it demonizes self-driving cars.
I'm happy demonizing self-driving cars, man. Those things are going to kill us all.
Yes, they are. I think it's funny. Logan Marshall Green, this is his movie, and then Tom Hardy, who he's often confused with, has a similar movie series with Venom.
Yeah,
where you know that's the you know somebody else is controlling what you do and everything. I just think it's funny how those guys always somehow may you know somehow like have a parallel to each other in some way. Yeah. But Upgrade is fantastic. I can't wait to revisit that one. It looks like we have time for one question here.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What are the best movies that had the unfortunate position to have been released with a film that overshadowed it?
I'll start. My answer is Deep Impact. I think Armageddon overshadows Deep Impact in a big way. And I actually think Deep Impact is a good watch. And it just doesn't have the cultural stickiness, apparently, that Armageddon did.
Yeah, this one I don't have an answer to. Will you read me the question again, sir?
Oh, yeah, sorry. What are the best movies that had the unfortunate position to have been released with a film that overshadowed it?
Oh, okay. So I see why you went with Deep Impact there. Mm-hmm. Deep Impact is much more watchable than how that played out would suggest. And I'm going to say the same thing about Dante's Peak with regard to Volcano. I think Dante's Peak is a better movie. I'm not sure either one of them are great, but Volcano way overshadowed Dante's Peak. And Pierce Brosnan's pretty good in that. And they do some, they actually have, I don't know if it's a landslide or a flooding, but they did some excellent miniature work that I've seen praised online several times in Dante's Peak. So that'll be my answer.
I don't have one that is like that, where you have a similarly themed thing like a Bug's Life and Ants. I see Ants being thrown into the chat there. Mine is more about when the movie came out and what came out that overshadowed it. And in this case, it's the movie Sorcerer that William Friedkin directed back in 1977. This was, I don't think it was his immediate follow-up to Exorcist. Maybe it was. But it was a confusingly titled name that people thought was, oh, Sorcerer is a freaking horror movie, right? And it's, you know, it's this survival movie with nitrogen bomb stuff with and trucks that the truck that's named Sorcerer in it or whatever, that they're carrying this like these bombs basically. But Sorcerer came out in the wake of Star Wars. It came out either the same week of Star Wars. I think that's what it was, where it came out just before Star Wars. And so once Star Wars came out, Sorcerer was instantly forgot about when it came out in theaters, and it has gotten a huge following since, but it took a long time. It took like in the last 10 years for it to get an actual following. So looking over at the chat, the aforementioned Ants from R1MA78, and then James says, even though they were a week apart, Black Panther absolutely overshadowed Annihilation. That's definitely another one. And Slab says, didn't The Thing come out the same time as E.T.? Yeah, a lot of movies in 1982 came out around E.T. E.T. overshadowed everything. So The Thing and Blade Runner both were huge box office bombs. Poltergeist came out during that same time, was a big hit. So what are you going to do? People want to watch what they want to watch when it comes down to it. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Next week is Upgrade. Looking forward to doing that one. Thank you, chat, for coming out and bringing it today. Absolutely love you guys. And we'll see you next time.
Bye, guys.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Sin.
save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.